Today, Iran lifts an internet blackout. We report on violent protests in the country. And an experiment to track how people are really getting their political news at this election. Three weeks ago, The Guardian's international correspondent Michael Safi watched as a story began to unfold in Iran.
On Thursday, the 14th of November, the government announced that in a few hours, at midnight that night, the price of fuel would increase, and it would increase to up to three times the price that it was. Within hours, we began to get reports of major demonstrations in Iranian cities.
These demonstrations quickly spread across the whole country.
This would go on to become the biggest protests, biggest challenge to the regime's legitimacy in the 40-year history of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
But what began as peaceful protests soon turned violent as the Iranian government responded with a brutal crackdown. It became impossible for activists to let the world know what was happening because the government also shut down the internet.
And then, as soon as the internet began to return, there was suddenly this flood of information, kind of unorganised information about what had happened in Iran for the last 5 or 6 days.
From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, reporting on Iran's deadly protests. You're in Jordan watching these videos on social media of these protests. How did you begin going about reporting on this story?
Well, at first I felt a bit overwhelmed by the volume of the video and the material out there. It was a lot of kind of grainy footage of people running, of gunshots, of fires. I thought, what if we were to pick one place and try and gather all the footage we could from that place and all the material we could, and instead of trying to tell the entire story from an event that was so obscured, why don't we just focus on one place and do our best to try to reconstruct key moments from that one city?
And what kind of place is Shiraz?
Shiraz is known as a kind of arts capital of the world, and certainly an arts capital of Persia. One of the activists I spoke with says that he was surprised at how large the protests were in Shiraz because it's a city of poetry and wine in Iran, and he joked that its people are not necessarily known for their revolutionary skills.
So you were gathering all these videos and focusing on Shiraz, but how were you managing to find out what was happening on the ground, and how were you able to verify information?
The first thing I did was cast as wide a net as possible, speak to as many activists as I could, scour the internet, scour Telegram for the hashtag Shiraz. Certain patterns started to emerge, buildings, places, incidents that were captured by more than one camera, particular landmarks. Like I kept seeing this bridge, which was clearly the site, firstly, of peaceful protests and then of people being beaten and then people being shot. One of the most valuable people who I worked with in this process was a US-based Iranian activist named Masih Alinejad.
I received the videos from 15 November, but this man who sent me...
She's been living in self-imposed exile in the US. She's frequently talked about by the regime as a kind of enemy of the state. But she has emerged as someone who can really inspire Iranians to challenge the regime around them. She has this amazing connection with people in the country, and they're willing to take a stand, to send her these videos and messages, knowing that she'll be able to publish them and make them and broadcast them to the world.
And what did she make of what she was seeing and being sent?
God, this is the video that this man actually filmed, Mehdi, who got killed in the street.
She was shocked. She was shocked by the bloodshed. She was shocked by the bravery of people.
Yeah, and then you can hear the last audio is from him that's saying that Masih, internet got freed from God. Oh my God.
You and Masih have this massive information. Take me through the timeline of what happened in Shiraz that weekend.
So through Masih, we managed to get three videos and an audio recording showing the scene at a petrol station at around 1 a.m. on Friday. So the petrol price hike had gone through about an hour before. There were cars banked up, people who'd been hoping to get to the petrol station before prices went up, and people were unhappy, they were frustrated. And there was a particular woman who, on the footage we received, was shouting at one of the people guarding the station and then at other drivers. And she was saying, "You're ruining us." Then the next day, on Saturday, as a form of non-violent civil disobedience, they park their cars in the middle of the street to protest this price hike and the general difficulty of getting by in Iran.
Were the protests peaceful?
In Shiraz, they certainly started peacefully. I mean, people were parking their cars in the middle of the street, getting out and chatting. They were sitting in the middle of big intersections, playing cards. There was a particular video we saw of people handing out flowers to the security forces, being applauded as they were doing so.
But it turned violent. Why?
Well, the videos that we have that we believe were recorded early on the Saturday show police standing by calmly, but then in videos that we believe were taken later that day, they are running through crowds, they're using their batons, they're firing tear gas, and then eventually they're shooting their weapons. And so there are several videos of gunshots being fired in the middle of these chaotic protest scenes. And in one particular video, we see the aftermath of the shooting of a young man called Mehdi Nekoui, who we understand was the first confirmed death inside Shiraz, and that we believe took place late on Saturday afternoon, and he was shot outside of a police station in Maliabad Boulevard in Shiraz.
That's horrific. What happened after he was shot?
Well, interviews and videos suggest that his shooting was the trigger for an escalation on the part of the protesters. And I've seen video of protesters tearing at the police station, and then a video from a few hours later shows the same building on fire. And we understand that by that evening, the Maliabad police station had been torched.
So this set a new, much more awful tone for protests then in the next few days.
We can't really know the order of things, but clearly as violence began to mount, the protests grew in intensity at the different places where they were being staged. So we know, for example, the next day in Sadra, which is a suburb north of Shiraz, protesters found the office of the local imam, like the local clerical chief, and he's, you know, appointed directly from the clerical establishment to oversee that area. Protesters went to his office and they set that on fire as well. And I mean, that's a direct attack on the legitimacy of the regime, of the kind of pillars of power. And in response, we saw the government send a helicopter into different areas, including Sadra. And I've heard activists have told me, and these are sort of uncorroborated accounts, that they were sort of mowing people down from helicopters, killing and wounding many people.
Oh my God. I mean, it just sounds like a war zone.
The protesters in some of the audio clips that we were sent talk about arming themselves with small weapons, with makeshift weapons. I mean, using the top of a bottle of Sprite and pushing nails into it as a way to sort of throw under the wheels of police motorbikes and cars. They talk about trying to use motorbikes as weapons themselves to try to ward off police and security personnel. I've seen videos, they show hand-to-hand combat between people in uniforms and protesters purportedly in Shiraz. For all intents and purposes, this was a kind of war that raged on the streets of Shiraz and, we're told, across the country for many days.
By Monday, the 18th of November, the government appeared to have retaken control of Shiraz. But what happened next?
The city was under internet blackout. There were said to be paramilitary people. They're called Basij, and they were, you know, pretty harshly like treating anyone who they could see on the streets. The city was virtually under curfew.
What began as a peaceful protest had, in just a few days, escalated to a street battle that resulted in many deaths. I mean, who were these people who were risking their lives?
Well, what makes these protests interesting compared to the last major outbreak of protests in Iran in 2009 is that from the evidence we have, it appears that the areas that protested, that rioted this time around, were working class areas, were areas of minority groups. Why that's significant is that working class Iranians have traditionally been the backbone of the Iranian regime. So the folks who normally are the protesters in Iran, the middle class, they're university students, they're kind of educated people who are arguing for their civil and political rights. In this case, it was people who are clearly struggling with the cost of living, struggling to get by. And that's important because that's a key plank of the Iranian regime's, the Iranian government's legitimacy. Then it shows that this is a vulnerable government, that this is a very, very difficult time for the Islamic Republic.
How does the size of these protests compare to ones that have happened in Iran before?
It is already the most significant protests in the country's 40-year history. So it's often compared to the 2009 so-called Green Revolution that followed Iran's disputed presidential election.
Bloodshed in the streets of Iran. At least seven people are reported to have been shot and killed after...
That was a kind of middle-class revolution in the main. That the Green Revolution had about 72 deaths. This one already has 208. So we're already more than three times, or nearly three times, the death toll that we saw in 2009.
So many people dead, Michael. How many are injured and how are they being treated?
Well, there are, conflicting reports, but it's thought to be roughly 2,000 people wounded. The reason why we can't say for sure is because people I talk to say that there are many people, at least dozens, probably more, who are injured but are not going to hospital because they're too afraid to check themselves in, fearing that intelligence agents will be monitoring the admissions lists, that they'll be raiding wards, and essentially by seeking medical treatment, they're giving themselves up to the regime.
Oh, that's absolutely terrifying. And is the government also detaining people?
Yes, according to an Iranian official, they've detained 7,000 people, and that was a few days ago, so the number is likely to be much higher now. According to the government's estimates, like 200,000 people were involved in the protests. Now, it's hard to know if that's accurate, but it also gives you a sense of just how much of a license they want to arrest people. You know, by making the protests seem that large, then they can justify a pretty enormous crackdown.
And do they usually shut down the internet?
No, this is something that Iran has been developing for about a decade. So they have been watching what China has done with its great firewall with a kind of envy and have been working the last 10 years to try to ring fence Iran's internet. I mean, but on the other side of that, they've been working to try to develop Iran's internal network. So encouraging businesses, for example, to bring all of their infrastructure and their services inside the country. This system, this internal intranet, sometimes called the halal net, Iran has been assisted in creating this system by the US, whose years of sanctions have forced Iranian companies as much as possible to try to work inside Iran. And so it's one of these perverse effects we see of the US sanctions regime against Iran, where it actually makes it easier for the Iranian government to shut down the internet without compromising all digital services inside the country itself.
Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, and the president, Hassan Rouhani, have blamed the unrest in the country on Iran's enemies overseas. What do they mean by that?
Well, Iran does have enemies overseas. I mean, let's put this in context. In 2015, the government of Iran signed a deal with the US, with China, with Europe and other countries in order to exchange its nuclear program for economic growth, for relief from sanctions.
I believe this is a historic moment. Today could have been the end of hope on this issue. But now we are starting a new chapter of hope.
Up until May 2018, it's indisputable that they were complying with that deal. Iran was doing everything we had asked them to do. But despite that, the Trump administration decided to pull out of the Iran deal.
I am announcing today that the United States will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal.
Arguing that it didn't do enough to curb Iranian behavior in other areas. So, for example, missile development, sponsorship of militias overseas.
The aim is to drive Iranian oil exports to zero. We're working with other countries to get alternative supplies for countries that are buying.
And that Donald Trump would use his deal-making prowess to bring Iran back to the table and negotiate a more comprehensive deal.
I am ready, willing, and able. Great things can happen for Iran. And great things can happen for the peace and stability that we all want in the Middle East.
Now, that hasn't happened yet. Instead, all we've seen is the imposition of incredibly harsh sanctions on the Iranian economy that suffocating ordinary people. For the Iranian government, it's easy to blame a foreign hand for what looks like genuine protests, things that are genuine expressions of discontent among Iranians. But we also have to acknowledge the fact that Iran is a country that has enemies, aggressive, well-financed enemies, that are doing its best to make life difficult for ordinary Iranians as a tactic, as a way to pressure their government.
What was life like for Iranians before the US imposed sanctions last year?
Well, conditions were not good for ordinary Iranians. I mean, Iran has basically been the victim of economic weapons in the form of sanctions for decades from the US, from Europe, and it has made ordinary life difficult for people there. But in 2015, there was a sense that there was a window opening through which the country could put those hostile relationships of the past behind it and begin to move towards a future in which it was more integrated with the world.
How have countries like the UK approached this situation with Iran and the country in general since America withdrew from that agreement?
Well, the agreement has put Europe in a very, very difficult position because from their perspective, there's no reason to break this deal. Everyone was complying with their part. Everyone was doing their part. And so they have said to the Iranians, cool your heels, try not to do anything rash, don't restart your nuclear program, and we'll try and find some way to get around the sanctions that the US has imposed. So, for example, there's been talk of the French lending the Iranian government billions of dollars to try to keep the economy afloat. European powers have also explored the potential for creating a barter system whereby business can be done in Iran without having to have money passed through banks that have links to the US, which would mean that they'd have to impose sanctions on the people doing business with Iran. So there have been months of furious efforts to try to find a way to throw a lifeline to the Iranian economy. And in order to try to increase that pressure, Iran has very gradually been moving towards restarting its nuclear operation, all of which they say they will roll back as soon as they get some kind of economic relief. It's worth adding that all of this takes place in an atmosphere of significant mistrust, much of it justified because throughout Iranian history, countries like Britain have not been a force for good. They've gone into the country, they've taken its oil, they've sucked out royalties. In the 1950s, they sponsored the overthrow of a democratically elected president in the country. From the Iranian perspective, they see all of these relationships they have with Western powers as very fraught, and that's they're quite justified because historically, it's been a history of colonialism, of treachery, and of violence.
What does the future look like, Michael, for protesters in Iran and for the government?
That's something a lot of us are now wondering. The kind of anger that we saw evidence of on the streets of Iran, the harshness of the government's response, all of that speaks to a kind of simmering fury that won't easily go away. It's hard to believe that people who are so unhappy, who have suffered a loss, who have seen that their government is willing to shoot and kill them, will go back home and return to their ordinary lives. But they've also seen that the cost of protesting is going to be very high. I think the Iranian government is entering one of its most vulnerable stages, and nobody quite knows how it'll end.
Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michael is continuing to report on the aftermath of the protests. Read his work at theguardian.com. Coming up, if you're keeping up with the election on your phone, do you really know what's going on? Now, for the past 5 weeks, The Guardian's media editor, Jim Waterson, has been tracking the election online and, in partnership with research agency Revealing Reality, has conducted a study to find out how people are using their phones to keep up with the election. 6 volunteers, all using pseudonyms and from different backgrounds and parts of the country, agreed to install an app on their phone that recorded their screen usage for 3 days. This showed what news they were reading, where they read it, and built up a picture of how this is shaping their opinions. For Jim, some of what he found surprised him.
During this election, everyone has been focused on how the media is shaping our politics. We've seen talk of fake news. We've seen a lot of discussion of Facebook ads. We've seen discussion about whether the BBC is fulfilling its remit to provide balanced coverage of the election. But a lot of the way that we look at it is still through the medium of old school outlets. We can cope with the idea of a biased newspaper. We can cope with the idea of scrutiny of a broadcaster. But what people aren't considering is how the general public are getting their news through their smartphone. And it's messy. It's a lot different to how we think of media consumption. There's memes flying all over the place. There's content from friends mixing with content from journalists, mixing with content from the politicians themselves. And no one has ever really managed to capture what this looks like. One of the more interesting ones we found while doing this study was a woman called Shazi, who's a health worker in Sheffield. She's in her late 30s, and she pretty much consumes her entire news through Twitter from following other Labour Party activists. She's a big fan of Jeremy Corbyn, but she doesn't own a TV, she doesn't own a radio, she doesn't really look at mainstream news websites. And so for her, the entire news agenda is set by what her friends, who are local Labour Party members, share on Twitter. For her, all she sees is videos of crowds chanting Jeremy Corbyn's name. And for her, that is a representation of what's really going on the ground. One of my favourites was a guy called Charlie, who's an accounts clerk in Sunderland. He's 37, he's got a few kids. And he is a former Lib Dem and UKIP voter. He's a fan of Brexit, but he's undecided whether to vote Conservative for the first time at this election. Now, he pretty much got most of his news from just surfing Facebook and seeing memes that were shared in like lad banter groups, things that were just mocking Jeremy Corbyn for being weak on terrorism. He saw a handful of headlines from traditional news outlets, and yet he described himself as the person in his friendship group that friends turn to in order to decide who to vote for. Now, you can make the argument that maybe he's got a better idea of what's going on the ground than most people who work in Westminster, but it does completely threaten that entire mentality that there is a central narrative to how politics is covered. Up in Bolton, we found Fiona. She's a student, she's 22. She's a massive fan of Boris Johnson and Brexit and really, really fears a Jeremy Corbyn government. Now, she is an obsessive reader of the news. She reads everything. She reads The Telegraph, which she agrees with. She reads The Guardian, which she often disagrees with. And then she'll go out and find the most provocative take on the news that she can find and put it on Facebook to annoy all of her left-wing fellow students. People are being smart enough to know that if you game the algorithm on your own friendship group, you can make the case for your own political candidate. So what have we learned from all of this? We're seeing people luxuriate in the fact that they can exist in a filter bubble. And not just that, they're actively loving it. They're going out to find things to annoy their friends, to please their friends, and embracing their status in that little world. And memes and influencers and all the stuff that we already understand is affecting the rest of our lives is now seeping into politics. The power of someone with 20, 30 million followers on Instagram is understandably probably more than most national newspapers. And really more than anything, and this is just across the board, left, right, pro-Brexit, anti-Brexit, people generally would look at headlines and not click them. And even if they clicked on a headline, very rarely read it to the end. the headline is probably the most powerful way that news organizations are getting their message across. All of this means that we're essentially lacking the tools to scrutinize what's really going on in the media at the moment. We're still all fixated on a handful of really big institutions and how they cover the news. But as people are instead getting their news content shaped by their phones, by algorithms from Twitter and Facebook, and by aggregators like Apple News and Upday if you're on Android, people don't understand why they're seeing what they're seeing. There's no rhyme or reason. In the past, you had a sort of patrician attitude to the public taken by journalists who would curate the news in the limited time and space available and choose the stories that they felt really mattered. Now, there's something to be said for blowing that up, and we have, to a certain extent, blown that up. But what we've replaced it with is a free-for-all of just endless shouting from all sides. There is a case to be made that expecting the general public to take responsibility for seeking out opposing views, for challenging themselves, is just a bit unreasonable. People don't have that amount of time. So really, there is a question as a society, to what extent are we happy to allow the choice of what news we see to be handed over to a few algorithms rather than a few editors who are based in newsrooms?
That was Jim Waterson. Thanks to him and Michael Safi. Today's episode was produced by Chika Ayres and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Kakutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.